listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Nearly 65 years after the fighting ceased on the Korean Peninsula, President Donald Trump announced at a press conference that peace may well be, in essence, at hand. Today we bring you part two of the one-hour press conference from Singapore featuring President Trump.
If you look, there has been no missile launches. They've blown up their missile area that's going to take place. That has not been written into the contract. We're going to give you the exact details on that. But they secured a halt of all missiles and of all nuclear tests. They secured the closure of their single primary nuclear test site, all three of them there in an area that's common around each other. They secured the closure. They secured the commitment to destroy the missile engine testing site. That was not in your agreement. I got that after we signed the agreement. I said, do me a favor. You've got this missile engine testing site. We know where it is because of the heat. It's incredible, the equipment we have, to be honest with you. I said, can you close it up? You couldn't close it up. We maintain the ability to continue to apply sanctions. So we're applying sanctions. Now, I had 300 sanctions that I was getting ready to put on last week. And I said, you know, I can't really put on sanctions when I'm meeting with. I thought it would be very disrespectful. 300 very big ones, powerful ones. And I said it would be disrespectful. So, Jennifer, when you look at all of those things that we got, and when we got our hostages back, I didn't pay $1.8 billion in cash like the hostages that came back from Iran, which was a disgraceful situation, what took place. So we've gotten a lot. So when I hear somebody in the media say that President Trump has agreed to meet, like, it's not a big deal to meet. I think we should meet on a lot of different topics, not just this one. And I really believe a lot of great things can happen. Yes, go ahead, please.
Sir, you just listed off a lot of things that you say you've got from this meeting. It wasn't too long ago, though, that you said you defined success of this meeting by North Korea giving up its nuclear weapons.
Well, that's what they're doing.
Well, can you talk about how...
Sure,
how
that's what they're doing. I mean, I don't think
Kim Jong-un for a complete, verifiable, irreversible...
Yeah, I didn't, honestly...
Can you say why you didn't secure those details in this agreement?
Because there's no time. I'm here one day. We're together for many hours intensively, but the process is now going to take place. And I would be surprised, Mike, if they haven't even started already. They have started. They blew up their sites. They blew up their testing site. So, but I will say, he knew prior to coming, you know, this wasn't like a surprise. It wasn't like we've never discussed it. We discussed it. Mike discussed it very strongly with his counterpart in North Korea. They knew that this was, let's say they didn't agree to that, I couldn't sign any agreement. There was no agreement that could have been signed. So they understood that. And it wasn't a big point today because really this had been taken care of more than any other thing because it was all about this. This has been taken care of before we got here. So when we brought that up today, you see the language, it's very strong. It's in the document. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. President. Could you talk about the military consequences for North Korea if they don't follow through on the commitments that you're talking about?
Well, I don't want to talk. Yeah, I know. That's a tough thing to talk about because I don't want to be threatening. I don't want to be threatening. They understood that. And you've seen what was perhaps going to happen. And, you know, Seoul has 28 million people. We think we have big cities. You look at New York where it has 8 million people. We think it's a big city. Seoul has 28 million people. Think of that. And it's right next to the border. It's right next to the DMZ. It's right there. I mean, if this would have happened, I think, you know, I've heard, 100,000 people. I think you could have lost 20 million people, 30 million people. This is really an honor for me to be doing this because I think, you know, potentially you could have lost, you know, 30, 40, 50 million people. The city of Seoul, one of the biggest cities in the world, is right next to the border.
You once spoke about fire and fury. Is that no longer the case?
Well, at that time we needed perhaps fire and fury because we could not have allowed that kind of capability from the standpoint of the United States. And certainly Japan wasn't going to allow it either. Japan is right next door.
One more thing, Mr. President, could you tell us about the video that you showed before this?
Yeah.
When did you show that to Kim? What was the goal?
Today. Yeah. We had it made up by some, I hope you liked it. I thought it was good. I thought it was interesting enough to show. One in English and one in Korean. And we had it made up. I showed it to him today, actually during the meeting, toward the end of the meeting. And I think he loved it. We didn't have a big screen like you have the luxury of having. We didn't need it because we had it on a cassette. And an iPad, and they played it. And about 8 of their representatives were watching it, and I thought they were fascinated by it. I thought it was well done. I showed it to you because that's the future. I mean, that could very well be the future. And the other alternative is just not a very good alternative. It's just not good. But I showed it because I really want him to do something. Now, I don't think I had to show it because I really believe he wants to. I think he wants to get it done. Yes, go ahead. How's Staten Island Ferry doing, okay? He wrote the best story about me with the Staten Island Ferry, and after that he's never written a good story. I don't know what happened. It's a long time ago.
Mr. President, it's been a busy week for you on the international stage. You're leaving the summit here in Singapore having determined that Kim Jong-un is a talented man. You left the G7 summit a few days ago in Canada having determined that Prime Minister Trudeau is weak and dishonest. What do you say to America's allies who worry that you might be jeopardizing our long-term alliances and who worry that you might be treating our historic friends as enemies and our historic enemies as friends?
Well, first of all, I think it's a very fair question. I had a very good meeting with the G7, and I left the meeting, and I'll be honest, we are being taken advantage of by virtually every one of those countries, very, very seriously. Now, The United States, because of bad management at the top, because of presidents that didn't care about trade or didn't understand it or whatever reason, for many years, with China being obviously the most successful at it, but the European Union is second, $151 billion we lost, they were represented at the meeting. And we're being taken advantage of on trade. Canada does have very big advantages over us in terms of trade deficits. We have a big trade deficit with Canada. I was reading where, oh, it's actually a surplus. Not a surplus. It's either 17, but it could actually be 100. You know, they put out a document. I don't know if you saw it. They didn't want me to see it, but we found it. Perhaps they were trying to show the power they have. It's close to $100 billion a year loss with Canada. They don't take our farm products, many of them. They charge what was 270%, but somebody told me the other day that a few months ago they raised it to 295% for dairy products. And it's very unfair to our farmers, and it's very unfair to the people of our country, the workers, the farmers, the companies. And we are not able to trade. They have tremendous barriers up. They have tremendous tariffs. So when I put in a countervailing tariff just to get us up a little bit so the balance isn't so much, it's like this. They said, oh, that's so terrible. I said, what's terrible? We have to catch you a little bit. We have to have a little balance. Even if it's not complete, we have to have a little balance. I say this with many countries. Anyway, we finished the meeting. Really, everybody was happy. And I agreed to sign something. I asked for changes. I demanded changes. And those changes were made. In fact, the picture with Angela Merkel, who I get along with very well, where I'm sitting there like this, that picture was, we're waiting for the document because I wanted to see the final document as changed by the changes that I requested. That was a very friendly, I know it didn't look friendly, and I know it was reported like sort of nasty both ways. I was angry at her. She, actually, we were just talking, the whole group, about something unrelated to everything, very friendly, waiting for the document to come back so I could read it before I leave. Anyway, I left and it was very friendly. When I got onto the plane, I think that Justin probably didn't know that Air Force One has about 20 televisions. And I see the television and he's giving a news conference about how he will not be pushed around by the United States. And I say, push him around. We just shook hands. It was very friendly. Look, countries cannot continue to take advantage of us on trade. The numbers are out over the last couple of years, and over the last many years, but over the last couple of years, this country has lost $800 billion on trade with other countries, the biggest one being China. $800 billion. $151 billion with the European Union. They don't take our agricultural products, barely. They don't take a lot of what we have, and yet they send Mercedes into us. They send BMWs into us by the millions. It's very unfair. And it's very unfair to our workers, and I'm going to straighten it out, and it won't even be tough. Okay? Thank you. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Following up on Bill's question, your relationship with Mr. Pence is stronger than it happened in 2 years ago. Do you plan on involving Congress in any way to move your bill or to move your nation?
I would like to involve Congress, yes. And no, I have a good relationship with Justin Trudeau. I really did. Other than he had a news conference that he had because he assumed I was in an airplane and I wasn't watching. He learned that's going to cost a lot of money for the people of Canada. He learned. You can't do that. You can't do that. We left. We had a very good relationship. I've had a good relationship with Justin. I have a good relationship with all. I have a very good relationship with Angela Merkel. But on NATO, we're paying 4.2%. She's paying 1% of a much smaller GDP than we have. We're paying 4.2% on a much larger. We're paying for, I mean, anyone can say from 60 to 90% of NATO. And we're protecting countries of Europe. And then on top of it, they kill us on trade. So we just can't have it that way. It's unfair to our taxpayers and to our people. But no, I have a good relationship with Justin, and I have, I think, a very good relationship with Chairman Kim right now. I really do. I think, I hope it's good, because if it is, we're going to solve a very big problem. I think we've gone a long way to solving it today. Should we keep going for a little while? I don't know. It's up to the legendary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Should we keep going, Sarah? Okay, we'll go. Well, I don't care. Hey, you know, it just means we get home a little later in the evening, right? Yeah, go ahead. Sure, go ahead. Go ahead.
Hi, Mr. President.
How are you?
I'm good. Nice to see you. Great science of Singapore. Welcome to the country.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed our food.
Beautiful country, I did.
I just have wanted to find out, you described this as a process. What is the immediate next step? Is there some ongoing dialogue?
Yes. Well, we're getting together next week to go into the details.
And that's
Secretary Pompeo, next week with John Bolton and our entire team to go over the details and to get this stuff done. We want to get it done. He wants to get it done. We're also working very much with South Korea. We're working with Japan. We're working with China to a lesser extent, but we're working with China.
And you're coming back to Singapore?
I would come back gladly. Your prime minister was fantastic. We were with him yesterday. He's done a great job. It was very welcoming. It really probably had it. It probably made a difference, actually. It's a great place. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. President. What was it about that first interaction with Chairman Kim this morning that made you decide not to walk away after you said that you would know within the first minute if he was sincere?
I've said that about relationships. I've said that about people. You know, in the first second, now I was generous, I said 5 seconds, but you know, in the first second, in some cases, sometimes that doesn't work out. But sometimes it does. From the beginning, we got along. But there's been a lot of groundwork. This wasn't like we went and we started talking about, as you know, right? We didn't just come in and start talking about these very complex subjects that have been going on for 70 years. We've been discussing this for months. And, you know, once the rhetoric stopped, once they did a great thing. You know, North Korea did a great thing by going to the Olympics. Because the Olympics, and President Moon will tell you this, the Olympics was not exactly doing great. People didn't feel like being bombed out of the opening ceremonies. You know, they weren't exactly selling tickets. And as soon as the chairman, Chairman Kim, said, let's participate in the Olympics, it sold like wildfire and was a great success as an Olympics. It was a great success. He did a great thing. But since that time, pretty much since that time, because as you know, a delegation came from South Korea who had just met with North Korea. They came to the White House. They told me lots of things, including the fact that they'd be willing to denuke. We have one of their great people here today, that they were willing to denuke. And once that started, we have been really talking about that from the end of the Olympics when the whole delegation came to say various things, including denuking.
If I may, a second question. In the document that you signed earlier today, North Korea agreed to commit to denuclearization. To borrow a phrase that you have used to criticize your predecessors and political opponents, how do you ensure that North Korea is not all talk, no action?
Well, I think, can you ensure anything? Can I ensure that you're going to be able to sit down properly when you sit down? I mean, you can't ensure anything. All I can say is they want to make a deal. That's what I do. My whole life has been deals. I've done great at it. And that's what I do. And I know when somebody wants to deal, and I know when somebody doesn't. A lot of politicians don't. That's not their thing. But it is my thing. I mean, again, this really could have been done, I think, easier a long time ago. But I know I just feel very strongly, my instinct, my ability or talent, they want to make a deal. And making a deal is a great thing for the world. It's also a great thing for China. Because I can't imagine that China has, you know, is happy with somebody having nuclear weapons so close. So, you know, China was very helpful. So I think he wants to make a deal. Can anybody be certain? But we're going to be certain soon because the negotiations continue. Okay, thank you very much. Go ahead.
You mentioned that you have raised extensively the issue of human rights with China.
Yes.
I wonder what you would say to the group of people who have no ability whatsoever to hear or to see this press conference, the 100,000 North Koreans kept in a network of gulags. Have you betrayed them by legitimizing the regime in Pyongyang?
No, I think I've helped them because I think things will change. I think I've helped them. There's nothing I can say. All I can do is do what I can do. We have to stop the nuclearization, we have to do other things, and that's a very important thing. So at a certain point, hopefully you'll be able to ask me a much more positive question or make a statement. But Not much I can do right now. At a certain point, I really believe he's going to do things about it. I think they are one of the great winners today, that large group of people that you're talking about. I think ultimately they're going to be one of the great winners as a group. Yes, sir. Go ahead. Yeah.
Would you ever consider removing the sanctions without significant improvement in the human rights situation?
No, I want significant improvement. I want to know that it won't be happening. And again, once you start that process, there'll be a point at which, even though you won't be finished for a while because it can't happen scientifically or mechanically, but you're not going to be able to go back. You know, once we reach that point, I'll start to give that very serious thought. Yes, go ahead. Go ahead. You first.
Mr. President, did you also discuss the cost of denuclearization and how North Korea is about to foot the bill while crippling sanctions remain in place on Chinese agents in Singapore?
Well, I think that South Korea and I think that Japan will help them very greatly. I think they're prepared to help them. They know they're going to have to help them. I think they're going to help them very greatly. We won't have to help them. The United States has been paying a big price at a lot of different places, but South Korea, which obviously is right next door, and Japan, which essentially is next door, they're going to be helping them. And I think they're going to be doing a very generous job and a terrific job. So they will be helping them. And yes, ma'am. Go ahead. Behind. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
I'd like to follow up on Steve's question. He asked how long it would take to denuclearize the North Korean peninsula. You said a long time. What does that mean?
Well, I don't know when you say a long time. I think we will do it as fast as it can be done scientifically, as fast as it can be done mechanically. I don't think, I've read horror stories. It's a 15-year process, okay? Assuming you wanted to do it quickly, I don't believe that. I think whoever wrote that is wrong. But there will be a point at which, when you're 20% through, you can't go back. I had an uncle who was a great professor for, I believe, 40 years at MIT, and I used to discuss nuclear with him all the time. He was a great expert. He was a great, brilliant genius, Dr. John Trump at MIT. I think he was there 40 years, I was told. In fact, the head of MIT sent me a book on my uncle. But we used to talk about nuclear. You're talking about a very complex subject. It's not just like, oh, gee, let's get rid of the nukes. It takes a period of time. But the main period of time that I'm talking is that first period when you hit a certain point, you can't go back. It's very hard to go back.
And how long will that take?
Oh, we don't know, but it'll go pretty quickly. Go ahead. Sure.
Thanks, Mr. President. I wanted to ask again on the sanctions campaign. You alluded at the very beginning that the Chinese are not doing as great a job securing the border as they were before. You expressed, you know, some doubts when Kim went to see President Xi. The Russian foreign minister was in Pyongyang and said there shouldn't be any sanctions while these negotiations are underway. And the South Koreans are now talking about restoring some form of trade. So with all of those players appearing to be moving toward eroding sanctions, how can you keep the sanctions regime in place? What leverage do you have on these countries?
Well, I think we have a lot of leverage. I think we have tremendous leverage. I do believe that China, despite my relationship with President Xi, a man who I told you I have great respect for and like also a lot, we're having very tough talks on trade. And I think that probably affects China somewhat, but I have to do what I have to do. And I think over the last 2 months, the border is more open than it was when we first started. But that is what it is. We have to do it. We have a tremendous deficit in trade, commonly known as a trade deficit. We have a tremendous deficit in trade with China. We have to do something about it. We can't continue to let that happen. And I think that has had an impact on my relationship in terms of the border. I don't think it has a relationship, you know, I don't think it affects my feeling or my relationship to President Xi, but when we first started, we weren't ready to go that route. And as we started preparing and getting ready to do that, I think that's had an impact on, frankly, the border, which is a shame. But I have to do it. I have no choice. For our country, I have to do it. South Korea will do whatever is necessary to get a deal done. If that means we can't trade, well, they're not going to trade. They're definitely not going to trade. If they think, and they would do this with
our concurrence if they think that they can do some work because we're very far down the line. We're actually very far. You know, that document, when you read it today, that's far down the line. That's not something that just happened to be put together. This was done over months. And again, the rhetoric was important and the sanctions were important. I don't even know which one was more important. They were both important. Yeah, go ahead.
President Steiner from the New York Times. I was wondering if you could give us some sense of whether Chairman Kim told you how many nuclear weapons he believes he's made, whether he's willing to turn those over first, and then whether in your mind you need to do more than was done in the Iran deal for actually dismantling the both the uranium and the plutonium processes, and whether or not you had a sense that Chairman Kim really understood what that involved and had a timetable in his own mind of shutting that.
Well, David, I can tell you he understands. He understands it so well. He understands it better than the people that are doing the work for him. That is an easy one. As far as what he has, it's substantial, very substantial. The timing will go quickly. I believe you'll see some good action. I mean, as an example, one of the things with the missile site, I think you're probably surprised to hear that that was a throw-in at the end, the missile site. But I really believe, David, that it's going to go very quickly. I really believe that it's going to go fast. And it is a very substantial arsenal. There's no question about it. You know, I used to say, maybe it's all talk and no action. But we have pretty good intelligence into that, although probably less there than any other country. You understand that maybe better than anybody in the room. Probably less there than any other country. But we have enough intelligence to know that what they have is very substantial. This is why, David, I always say that this shouldn't have taken place so late into the process. Wouldn't this have been better if it was 5 years ago or 20 years ago or 15 years ago and we didn't have to worry about not having a successful meeting like today? So, and I still love my first interview with you, David. I still have that interview, actually. Yeah, go ahead. Thank you.
If there is a second summit with the chairman Kim Jong-un, will it be in Pyongyang or Washington?
We haven't set that up. We'll probably need another summit. We'll probably need, or meeting, we can use a different term. But we'll probably need another one. I will say this, we're much further along than I would have thought. I did not think we'd be here. I thought, and I've told people, I didn't want to build up people's hopes too much. I told people, I thought that this would be a successful meeting if we got along, we developed a relationship, and we could have maybe gotten to this point in 3 or 4 months from now. But it really happened very quickly. A lot of that was because of the foundation that was, you know, put down before we met. A lot of things happened very fast. We didn't have, as an example, bringing back the remains. That was not one of the things that was on our agenda today. I brought it up at the very end because so many people had talked to me about it. And I brought it up at the very end, and he was really very gracious. Instead of saying, well, let's talk about it the next time, he said, it makes sense. We will do it. And he knew, you know, they know where many of those incredible people are, where they're buried. Along roads, along highways, along paths, usually, because our soldiers were moving back and forth and they had to move rapidly. It's very sad. But he knew, and that was brought up at the very end. And, you know, it was really great that he was able to do it. A lot of people are going to be very happy about that. Yes, go ahead, please.
Thank you.
Robinson, One American News. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you for the nice way you treat us. We appreciate it. Really, it's very good. It's really beautiful what you do. Go ahead. And now I'll probably get this killer question.
Well, I do want to talk about the future of North
okay.
Korea.
It's all right.
Specifically, the people are Kim Jong-un is saying he's wanting a brighter future with prosperity for his people, yet we know they lived under oppression. You showed him this video of what the future could be like. But do you have an idea specifically of the model that he would like to go towards economically? Is he open to more economic freedom?
It's a good question. So you saw a tape. today. And that I think was done really well, but that was done at the highest level of future development. I told him, you may not want this. You may want to do a much smaller version of this. I mean, you're going to do something, but you may want to do a smaller version. You may not want that with the trains and the everything, you know, super everything, the top. And maybe you won't want that. It's going to be up to them. It's going to be up to them. It's going to be up to the people what they want. They may not want that. I can understand that, too. But that was a version of what could happen, what could take place. As an example, they have great beaches. You see that whenever they're exploding their cannons into the ocean, right? So I said, boy, look at that. Wouldn't that make a great condo behind? And I explained. I said, you know, instead of doing that, you could have the best hotels in the world right there. Think of it from a real estate perspective. You have South Korea, you have China, and they own the land in the middle. How bad is that, right? It's great. But I told them, I said, you may not want to do what's there. You may want to do a smaller version of it or, you know, and that could be. Although I tell you what, he looked at that tape, he looked at that iPad, and I'm telling you, they really enjoyed it, I believe. Okay? Yeah, go ahead. A couple of more. Okay, we'll do three more. Yeah, go ahead. Go. Yes, hi, Brian. My other cover again this week? Boy, have I been have so many covers. Huh? I know. That's okay.
Do you now see Kim Jong-un as an equal?
In what way?
You just showed a video that showed you and Kim Jong-un on equal footing and discussing the future.
I think that I don't view it that way. See, I don't view it that way. I'll do whatever it takes to make the world a safer place. If I have to say I'm sitting on a stage, I mean, I understand what you're getting at. If I have to say I'm sitting on a stage with Chairman Kim, and that's going to get us to save 30 million lives, could be more than that, I'm willing to sit on the stage. I'm willing to travel to Singapore very proudly, very gladly. Again, I you know, other than the fact that it is taking my time, they have given up a tremendous amount. They've given it up even before, and even add the Olympics to it. You know, you could add the Olympics to the question. They went to the Olympics. They took an Olympics that was going to be a massive failure, that maybe wouldn't have even opened, and they made it a tremendous success by agreeing to.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening. Next, this very interesting interview of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad brought to us from Press TV's Damascus Bureau Chief, Hossan Murtada.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Mr. President, there are many issues which we will talk about, but in the light of the victories you have achieved, the main focus remains the south of Syria. What's happening exactly, or what is the nature of what is happening in the south of Syria?
To put it simply, after the liberation of Al-Ghouta, it was suggested that we should move south. We were faced with two options, as in the case in all other areas in Syria, reconciliation or liberation by force. At this point, the Russians suggested the possibility of giving reconciliation an opportunity, similar to what happened in other areas, in order to restore the situation that prevailed before 2011. In other words, for the Syrian army to be deployed in that area, which is an area of confrontation with the Zionist enemy. And of course, the terrorists should leave the area. This proposition suits us. Up till now, there are no concrete results for a simple reason, which is Israeli and American interference. For they put pressure on the terrorists in that area in order to prevent reaching any compromise or peaceful resolution. That is how the situation stands now.
So it's not been decided whether to move toward a military operation or toward reconciliation?
No. Contacts are still ongoing between the Russians, the Americans, and the Israelis, while nobody is communicating with the terrorists, because they are mere tools, and they implement what their masters decide ultimately. This is what happened. There was an opportunity to reach reconciliation, but the American and Israeli interference prevented that possibility.
Of course, this is the reality there, but on the other hand, there are those who talk about many things taking place in the South. Mr. President, is there a certain deal? What is the price? Is there really a price for concluding this deal in the South? Let me talk frankly about the issue of getting the Iranians to leave the southern region in return for Al-Tanf, for example. What did the Americans demand? Or let's say, what was the price the Americans asked to approve the reconciliation process in the South?
الأمريكي للموافقة على عملية تسوية إذا صح التعبير في منطقة الجنوب. بالنسبة للأمريكي هناك مبدأ عام.
For the Americans, there is a general principle they follow in dealing with any problem in the world. The only price they ask for is absolute hegemony, regardless of the issue and the place. Of course, we shall never provide that price. Otherwise, we wouldn't have fought this war for years. We have been fighting for the independence of Syrian decision making, for the Syrian homeland, and for the unity of Syrian territory. As for Iran in particular, let me be very clear. The Syrian-Iranian relationship is a strategic one, not subject to a deal in the south or in the north. This relationship, in terms of its implications and results on the ground, is linked to the present and future of the region. Consequently, it is not subject to the price tags of the international bazaar. Neither Syria nor Iran has floated this relationship on the international political bazaar for it to be subject to haggling. The proposition was made by the Israelis with the objective of provoking and embarrassing Iran. At the same time, this comes in line with the international propaganda campaign launched against Iran regarding the nuclear file. It is not a separate issue, for everything happening now is linked to Iran in order to create an international position against it. As for us in Syria, the decision concerning our land is an exclusively Syrian decision. We are fighting the same battle, and when we have a decision concerning Iran, we will talk about it with the Iranians and not with any other party.
Of course, we will talk about Iran and in more detail. But since we are talking about the southern front, let's explore it further. Practically in the same context, there is the MOC, which hasn't stopped its operation since the beginning of the war on Syria about 8 years ago. It is working and is still active and is directly linked to the Israelis. But we have noticed recently that it has been reactivated and there are more communications. Mr. President, does this mean that the Syrian state is practically moving toward a military decisive action in the south, regardless of the consequences, whether things reach a stalemate or not? Is there a decisive action in the cards for the Syrian leadership?
No. Mock has nothing to do with this decision. Mock has been linked to the presence and the role of the terrorists since the beginning of the war on Syria. That's why it existed, in order to lead them militarily. Consequently, the continued existence of this operations room means the continuation of the role given to these terrorists. They are equipped and prepared to carry out more terrorist acts. Mock is linked to the terrorists and not to the role of the Syrian state. Our role has nothing to do with it. Our decision has been clear from the beginning. We will liberate all Syrian lands. As to when to move south, north, east, or west, this is purely military issue. But regardless of Mock, we have moved towards the south and we are giving the political process a chance. If that doesn't succeed, we have no other option but to liberate it by force.
But there's a confrontation in the south, and the issue is not limited geographically to Syria in the larger political sense. There are the Americans, the Russians, the Iranians, the Israelis, and Hezbollah. All these parties are there in the area. What does that mean? How are you going to deal with this?
You are talking about two axes. One supporting terrorism and represented by the US, Israel, and some flunkies in the region, including some Arab and non-Arab states, and an anti-terrorist axis. The first axis supports terrorism and seeks hegemony, while the second axis seeks independence. So, there can be only one result for this confrontation: the victory of one of these axes. At least, as far as the anti-terrorist axis is concerned, it will not give up the process of cleaning Syria and the region of terrorism, and will not give up on the unity of Syrian territory. As to the other axis, will it change as a result of the reality on the ground? Let's wait and see. But in terms of substance and convictions, it will not change. While in terms of the political practices dictated by reality and the facts on the ground, it might.
Will the Americans leave Al-Tanf?
The Americans say they are ready, but everyone knows that the Americans are historically professional liars in politics, so why should we believe them? Also, we have to wait and see.
Mr. President, what's happening now in Jordan? Is it linked to what's happening on the southern front in particular? That is it linked to what's being plotted in that region, in your view?
In fact, the only information we have is what we hear in the media. In any case, we wish Jordan stability, not chaos, because the latter will have a negative impact on us.
Since we are talking about the South, let's close this file. Mr. President, what would make the Israeli occupation agree to the return of the Syrian army to the borders? That is, a return to the situation which existed at the beginning of 2011, after 7 years of repeated Zionist attempts directly and indirectly to undermine the Syrian state, the regime in Syria, and stability in Syria. Why would it agree now to the return of the Syrian army to the borders and to the occupied Golan?
Certainly, neither conviction, morality, nor international law means anything to the Israelis. Since the beginning of the war, particularly when it started to have a clear military nature on the southern front in particular, the Israelis used to shell Syrian forces continuously and consequently provide direct support to the terrorists. Israeli artillery and aircraft are the terrorists' artillery and aircraft. That applies to Jabhat al-Nusra, of course. Nothing is going to change this Israeli approach. As far as we are concerned, Israel's approval had no role at all. Despite Israeli support to the terrorists, we have been doing our job, and the Syrian army is fighting its way towards the southern front and has liberated a number of areas within the limits of its capabilities. So, with or without its approval, the decision is a Syrian one, and this is a national duty we shall carry out.
So a return of the Syrian army is better than having resistance in the Golan, for instance?
For the Israelis?
Yes.
I think the two options are bad for the Israelis. Both of them are bad. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has repeatedly talked about Syria's relationship with the resistance and a Syrian role in the resistance. So, how would the Israelis choose between two bad things for them?
As you said, Mr. President, Israel has financed, supported, and more dangerously been capable of enlisting a large number of Syrians, some of whom were treated inside occupied Palestine. They talked about it. In the future, how would you deal with this large number of Israeli agents? Maybe some of them were deceived, and Israel might have exploited the financial and living conditions of some others. And some have chosen to side with the Israelis. How would you deal with them in the future?
This is true. We cannot put everyone in the same basket. There are different reasons for moving in this wrong direction. And these people have wronged the homeland and every Syrian citizen. Ultimately, they are the children of this homeland, and we all bear responsibility for this problem, not only those who have done wrong. When crime, for instance, becomes widespread in a certain country, the whole society bears responsibility for this crime, not only the security agencies or the criminals themselves. The first thing that should be done is to accommodate these people. Second, we need to address the root causes which led to this case of weak patriotism. The causes here are many and complicated, and the scope of this interview doesn't allow for all of them to be mentioned.
In the same context, while you're talking about restoring the Syrian air defense systems and confronting the Zionist occupation, statements have been made by leaders of the Israeli entity that they will strike at the depth of the Syrian territory. How would you deal with that situation, particularly that balance has been achieved recently, that is, balance between the Israeli aggressions and the Syrian responses?
Basically, we haven't stopped responding. First of all, we haven't stopped fighting terrorists. And at the same time, we haven't stopped responding to Israeli aggression within the capabilities available to us, militarily and technically. Moreover, the more these capabilities improve, the response will be better and higher. But in fact, the strongest response to Israel now is to strike the Israeli army existing in Syria, which consists practically of the terrorists.
Full formations.
Of course, for they are acting clearly and starkly in Israel's interest. The first acts they carried out were attacks against the air defense systems. What is the link between air defense systems and the terrorists acting as infantry on the ground? This was an Israeli order. It was an Israeli-American order because it is the same thing. So, they are Israel's army inside Syria. And the first strike against Israel, politically, militarily, and in every other area, is to strike Israel's terrorists inside Syria. Whether they belong to ISIS, al-Nusra, or the other groups linked to the Israeli plan and strategy.
And you invited Iranian advisors to come?
This is what's happening. It's escalating, and we are responding. Ultimately, we are fighting the war within the capabilities available to us, and we are doing our best within these capabilities. A response does not need a political decision. I stress that responding or not responding is not a political decision. It is a national decision, and it was taken from day one. But implementing this decision depends on what we can do militarily and not politically.
In terms of capabilities, there's one issue in the media which we are always following. That is the S-300 Russian missiles. Russia says, we will deliver these missiles, and then says, we will not deliver them, which means that the issue is not clear. What is happening exactly? Why is Russia hesitating, in your view, to deliver the S-300 missiles to Syria, while some other countries have been seeking S-400? Does this mean they are ahead of us in this regard?
You know that military action and military considerations are part of political considerations. Consequently, a statement, even if it is of a military nature, carries at the same time political messages. So, why did the Russians say that they want to send or not send? This is a statement that the Russians should be asked about because it might be part of their political tactics. As to the military aspect of the statement, which concerns Syria, it's not our custom to talk about the weapon which we will be delivered or not delivered. The evidence was that the weapons used in response to the last two aggressions, the tripartite aggression, and after that the Israeli aggression, were not announced by Syria. We traditionally do not announce cases of technical military nature.
So even the nature of the response is not linked to the issue of the S-300 missiles?
No, the same applies. Even if the S-300 missiles will be provided or not provided, we will not say that they were delivered to Syria. A weapon is used when it must be used.
Is there a possibility that you've developed certain weapons?
This remains a possibility. In any case, the result is the same. Weapons shouldn't be talked about until they are used. Weapons announce themselves only when they are used.
Mr. President, let's return to the political aspect, since we are talking about the Southern Front. Regarding the general situation, in light of all that has been achieved in Syria today, the most prominent actor is the Tripartite Alliance, or what is being called the Tripartite Alliance. I mean Syria, Iran, and Russia. What is the nature of this alliance? Is it a temporary alliance in the sense that it is linked to fighting terrorism or certain developments on the Syrian perspective? Recently, we have started to see, or let's say some have focused on certain points in order to show a certain fracture in this alliance. What is your take on that, and what is the actual reality of this alliance?
If we talk first about the Syrian-Iranian part, for 40 years and in the different conditions that the Middle East region has gone through, this alliance remained solid. So, there is no reason to say that it is temporary or otherwise. The new element in the war on Syria is the Russian element, and that's why this tripartite alliance came into existence. Our relationship with Russia is now about 7 decades old. despite the fluctuations and the fall of the Soviet Union, the rule of President Yeltsin, and the deterioration of these relations to a large degree for us, it has never reached the stage of reversing this relationship with Syria. Russia continued to deal with Syria as a friendly state, and we have imported everything from Russia, including weapons, during the different stages of the sanctions imposed on Syria. It is not in the nature of the Russians to build temporary or self-serving alliances or to sell out on relations in order to get deals done. The relationship is definitely a strategic one, but the political statements allowed for these speculations. These statements also aim at sending messages in different directions. Maybe sometimes the language or the choice of particular terminology might not be helpful and might take the statement in a different direction, at odds with the content of the statement. This happens from time to time. However, these statements shouldn't be taken out of context. The Russian view of the relationship with Iran is a strategic one. As for Syria, the Russians do not interfere in Syrian affairs. If they have a certain opinion, they raise it with us and say that. In the end, the decision is that of the Syrian leadership and the Syrian people. This is a constant principle for Russia. Therefore, the alliance is a strategic one, and if there are differences, such differences happen within the Syrian state, and you see differences within the Iranian state and within the Russian state. It is natural for us to differ on daily tactical details. For why conduct a dialogue if we agree on everything? We meet extensively in order to reach agreement.
So this tripartite alliance is being consolidated.
Of course, this is dictated by reality, interest, and international changes that make it necessary for this alliance to be consolidated. As long as the other axis supports terrorism, and as long as we, together with Iran and Russia, feel the danger of terrorism, not only in Syria but also on all these countries and on the whole world, and as long as Syria, Iran, and Russia realize the importance of abiding by international law, these facts make the existence of this alliance necessary.
But there are those who say that Syria will get a price if the Iranians leave Syrian territories. Is there a certain political, moral, or military price in this regard?
As I said in the beginning, as long as this relationship is not floated in the bazaar, they cannot offer a price, and the answer will be clear. That's why they don't dare suggest this price. This issue was raised by different countries, including Saudi Arabia, for instance, at the beginning of the war. And not only at the beginning, but at different stages. The proposition was that if Syria cut its relationship with Iran, the situation in Syria will be normal. This principle is basically rejected by us.
So there were initiatives, so to speak, made in this regard by Saudi Arabia.
During the war?
Yes.
Of course, more than once, and in a clear manner.
Directly?
Directly. The relationship with Iran was the basis for every proposition, and Saudi Arabia's position on this subject is public. I am not revealing a secret.
An issue has been raised in Syria, Iran, or Lebanon about the nature of the Iranian presence in Syria. Some call them Iranian advisors. Even the Syrian foreign minister used the same term. At the same time, we noticed that there are Iranian martyrs. Frankly, Mr. President, what is the nature of the Iranian presence in Syria now?
The term advisor is sometimes used in a broad manner. These advisors have been with us through the long-standing relationship with Iran, even before the war, because the military relationship is close. When a military formation moves to a fighting position, the advisor becomes a fighter. So, the word can be used in different senses. There are certainly Iranian advisors in Syria, and there are groups of Iranian volunteers who came to Syria, and they are led by Iranian officers. Iran has fought with and defended the Syrian people. It offered blood. That's why when we say advisors, this is a generic term. But this doesn't mean that we are ashamed of any Iranian presence, even if it is official. But we use the word advisors because there are no regular Iranian fighting units in Syria.
Full formations.
Exactly. There are no battalions or brigades or divisions. First, we can't hide them. And then, why should we be ashamed of that? When we invited the Russians legally to come to Syria, we were not ashamed of that. And if there were an Iranian formation, we would announce it. Because such relations need agreements between the two states endorsed by parliaments. Such relations cannot be concealed.
And you invited Iranian advisors to come?
Of course. From the beginning, we invited the Iranians, and then we invited the Russians. We needed the support of these countries, and they answered the call.
Mr. President, you said more than once that there are no Iranian bases in Syria.
That's correct.
So how come there are no Iranian bases while we notice that there are a number of Russian ones?
There is nothing that prevents the existence of such bases, as long as Iran is an ally, as is Russia. If we ask, we will ask them to agree. I mean, that we could ask for the existence of such forces to support us. Iran has never asked and does not have an interest except in fighting terrorism. But the evolution of the war made it necessary to develop the nature of this presence. This happened as far as the Russians are concerned. In the beginning, Russian support, like Iranian support, was different from what it is today. The support for terrorism has developed internationally and globally when the Syrian army confronted those terrorists. And with that, Russian and Iranian military presence developed. At a certain stage, we found, with the Russians of course, that the existence of air bases was necessary to provide air support to the Syrian army. And now, if we find, in cooperation, coordination, or dialogue with the Iranians, that there is a need for Iranian military bases, we will not hesitate. But now, Iranian support in its present form is good and effective.
Why haven't you visited Iran so far, although you visited Russia more than once?
That's correct. In fact, there was a scheduled visit to Iran a few months ago, and it was postponed and not cancelled. It was postponed because of an emergency in Syria related to the development of battles. There is certainly no reason which prevents such a visit, and I'll visit Iran hopefully soon on the earliest opportunity. This is natural, but the issue is logistic, no more, no less.
Mr. President, I move to another file. Last week, it was the Jerusalem International Day, and the Palestinian cause is going through its most difficult stages. We are talking about the deal of the century and moving the American embassy to occupied Jerusalem. What do you have to say about Palestine? Is Syria still capable of supporting the Palestine cause? Basically, wasn't one of the most important objectives of the war on Syria to get Syria out of the axis of resistance and to prevent it from supporting resistance, whether in Lebanon or Palestine?
The Palestine context, since 1948 up till now, has been a complicated one because the regional context is complicated. Of course, it is complicated because the colonial West, which is particularly supportive of Israel, has always created elements which aim at one single thing. First, to drive to desperation the Arab citizen, who is historically attached to the cause of Palestine and who has always considered it a pan-Arab cause that touched him even on the national level. The other objective has been to distract the Arab peoples together with states or societies in general to marginal causes so that they do not have time to think about Israel. And they have succeeded to a great extent, most recently through the so-called Arab Spring, which has aimed at destroying the political, military, and psychological infrastructure of Arab societies. Nevertheless, recent developments have proven that the Arab people is still conscientiously attached to the cause of Palestine. As for Syria, since it has been part of these plots to undermine the Arab condition in general, first, for Syria to support the cause of Palestine, it should first of all destroy the Israeli army in Syria. Restoring stability in Syria, striking terrorism, and foiling the Israeli plot in Syria is certainly part of supporting the cause of Palestine. The support might be indirect with direct consequences, but these direct consequences are linked to the internal Palestinian condition. We shouldn't forget that the Palestinians are divided between groups which resist Israel and are genuinely linked to the cause of Palestine, and other groups which are against the resistance and support surrenderist and defeatist peace, while there are other groups which use resistance as a title in order to achieve their political objectives under the slogan of religion. This is, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood's approach.
Are you prepared to offer whatever the resistance asks of you, whether in the form of political, military, or any other form of support?
Politically, we haven't changed. The Palestinian question for us is still as it was 10 years ago and decades ago. It hasn't changed. As to what we can offer, this has to do with two things. First, Syria's current capabilities, and there is no doubt that the priority is given now to cleaning Syria of terrorism. Second, it has to do with the Palestinian condition and the parties with which we can deal within the Palestinian arena.
Since we are talking about resistance, there's the other side. In addition to some countries which stood beside Syria in fighting terrorism, there was also a role played by the resistance in Lebanon, particularly Hezbollah, which provided a great deal and contributed to fighting terrorism. What do you say, Mr. President, to resistance fighters and families of martyrs and the wounded?
When all these groups of resistance get together to defend Syrian soil and Syrian citizens, including the Lebanese resistance and the brothers who came from Iraq, some of whom reproached me for not mentioning them by name, I take this opportunity to stress that there are brothers from Iraq to whom we give the same weight of any resistance fighter who came from any other country. There are also the families of resistance fighters who came from Iran and sacrificed their blood in Syria. We should put all these in the same basket next to the Syrian martyrs, fighters, and their families. To those I say that all the letters, the words, the sentences, and the whole of literature are much less than a single drop of blood. Therefore, words are of a much lesser value than what they have offered. What's more important is what history will write about them. In fact, when we talk about writing history, we need to highlight that history needs a strategy and needs. But the fact remains that strategy without implementation on the ground has no value. It remains mere thought, which we might include in books and essays. But the reality is that these individuals in these countries, this group of resistance fighters, not politics, write history. I would like to use the answer to this question to express to them all my love, respect, and appreciation, and my reverence to the fighters, the wounded, and martyrs, and to all their families who are courage incarnated and who send these individuals to Syria to defend it and fight terrorism, so that these families become models of morality and principles for present and future generations.
Have you asked Hezbollah to leave Syria? A few days ago, His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah talked about this issue and said that nobody can get us out of Syria unless the Syrian leadership asks us to do so.
The battle is long and ongoing. When we talk about this tripartite alliance, and if we consider it a quadruple alliance when we add Hezbollah, we talk about the tripartite alliance in terms of the states included. But in the end, Hezbollah is a basic element in this war. The battle is long, and the need for these military forces will continue for a long time. When there is a need, and when Hezbollah, Iran, or others believe that terrorism has been eliminated, they will tell us that they want to go home. As Sayyid Hassan said, they have families and daily interests, which is normal, but it is still early to talk about this subject.
At the moment, there are still areas under the control of the terrorists and the occupiers. At the same time, regretfully, some Arab countries, and here I am talking particularly about Saudi Arabia, have announced that they are ready to send forces to Syria. On the other hand, a few days ago, popular tribal units were formed to resist occupation. Are these really popular resistance units? Do they receive support from the Syrian government? Does this mean that the army cannot liberate those areas and that's why it is asking for the help of the tribes? What is the nature of this issue?
There are different forms of this resistance which appeared a few years ago. In the beginning, they were fighting ISIS before they started to fight the occupiers. They were against ISIS in the central and eastern regions, and there were cases where they appeared in other regions which were not given media coverage and about which we hear sometimes through information and indications. Now, this situation has started to expand. So, it's not one single case. There are a number of cases which might be individual sometimes, or in the form of small groups not affiliated to an organization. In any case, our position as a state has been from the beginning to support any act of resistance, whether against terrorists or against occupying forces, regardless of their nationality, American, French, Turkish, or Israeli. We support these resistance forces based on our national role as a government.
What about Saudi Arabia and sending Saudi forces to Syria?
First, when we talk about a state, we should assume that such a state can take decisions independently. That's why we will not talk about the role of Saudi Arabia. You better ask me about the American decision on this issue.
On the other hand, there are a number of Arab countries that we talked about and had a role in the destruction of Syria. These countries are now trying to get to Syria through the reconstruction process. What do you think about this, particularly that these countries have huge financial power? How are you going to deal with that?
Reconstruction in Syria is not a cause for concern for us. It needs two factors. First, the human factor, which is more important than the financial factor. When a country like Syria possesses the human factor, the financial cost will be less when it comes to reconstruction. This is self-evident, and we possess all these factors despite the fact that many competent and qualified Syrians have immigrated because of the war. But we still have the capability to start reconstruction. And the evidence is clear now, for the state is moving forward and reconstruction has begun. As to money, the Syrian people have financial capabilities, capital, most of which is not in Syria, but outside Syria. But there is capital waiting for reconstruction to begin, so it will begin investing. On the other hand, there are the friendly countries which have capabilities and have the desire, and we have the desire to have them participate in reconstruction, so that they benefit and we Syrians benefit from this process. In the end, we do not need those countries and we will never allow them to be part of reconstruction.
Never?
Absolutely.
Not even if there was a need in this regard, I mean in terms of financial resources?
Financial resources are not everything. As I said, this is available. There are different sources in the world and in Syria for capital.
With these tough years, we're talking about the legendary steadfastness of the Syrian army, the Syrian people, the armed forces. If you wanted to talk about two cases, the most difficult case or incident that you have encountered during these years, and on the other hand, the best and most beautiful case, what would they be?
It is natural, at the heart of the military battle, for the best and worst cases to be linked to the development of the military battle. If I say that the worst cases were when terrorists used to control a certain area, this is self-evident. But it is related more to specific battles, particularly when the area is strategic or the city is big with a large population. Consequently, the impact will be much greater psychologically and in terms of morale. But there was an ongoing situation, which we are still living and we must think about. When a martyr or a group of martyrs fall, and this is ongoing on a weekly basis for us, we must think that a family lost a dear one who cannot be compensated. He might be compensated by achieving victory at a certain stage, but on the family, psychological and human level, you cannot compensate a dear one lost to a certain family, or maybe a friend. This is a very painful situation, which we have lived and continue to live. This will not stop until the war itself stops. But there were painful cases at the beginning of the war, when you see this huge lack of patriotism. They were perhaps a minority, but a large minority of individuals who were prepared to sell the homeland and trade it together with their principles, if they had ones, in return for money or a certain interest, in addition to a certain percentage of extremism. On the other hand, there were victories, particularly when victories started in the city of Al-Qusair in 2013. And culminated in the city of Aleppo in 2016. That was the beginning of the major victories. That was followed by Deir ez-Zor. And today, we are living the joy of liberating Damascus and its countryside. This is a situation we have all lived through. And you were with us, and I am sure you feel the same joy.
Have you felt tired at a certain moment? Have you felt hesitant at a certain moment in light of all the decisions you have taken? Have you ever, even for a moment, thought of leaving? Haven't you said to yourself, let me save my family and resign, as some people did at a certain point in time?
This question might be raised in a personal manner. When I am faced with a personal situation as an individual, I might feel despair after a few months. I might feel tired or bored, or I might want to move to a different situation or give up. That is possible.
As an individual?
Of course, as an individual, but the case you are proposing is not personal, it is national. Imagine yourself in a different condition, perhaps building something on your own. You feel tired, but when you see a large number of people helping you build it and share the same determination, you forget the tiredness. Now we are in a national situation. We are talking about millions of Syrians. When you see a shell striking and victims falling anywhere in Syria, you feel frustrated. But when you see life being restored to the same area after 1 hour, your psychological condition changes. When you see that the electricity worker, the oil worker, the teacher, the employee are moving side by side with fighters, moving without despair and without tiredness, how can you feel tired? This is a collective condition, not related to me as a person. It has to do with our human condition when we are together as a society. How do we live? This defines whether you are tired or not. Would the Syrian society have arrived at this stage of despair and surrender, I would certainly have been with it. I would have surrendered because I do not have the necessary elements for steadfastness. This is self-evident.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, for giving us this opportunity and for being candid in answering these questions. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.